Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Guild Podcast, the podcast for the Writers, Artists, and Readers Guild. My name is Chris Mary Holtman, and I am your host. I would say that this new kind of year is starting out kind of good with the interviews. I have a lot of interests coming in, a lot of people on the list of being interviewed, and skewing a little bit more towards fantasy than it did last year, which was a lot of horror. But that is fine. We can talk of all of it. I'm guessing maybe next year, maybe it'll be romance. I don't know. Anyway, today we have H.L. Tinsley as our interviewee, and it is very exciting and interesting. In chat about fantasy, about grimdark, the origins of fantasy, and we talk a little bit about different parts of like how to categorize or the genres fantasy into its subgenres and what they might mean. But I'll let you listen to that yourself. So, H.L. Tinsley is the author of We Men of Ash and Shadow, now available on Amazon. I think you should go check that out. It seems very like a very interesting book. I have yet to read it, but I'm hoping to soon. So without further ado, let's talk to H.L. Tinsley. At this time, I would like to welcome H.L. Tinsley to the podcast. Welcome to the Guild Podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
How are you doing? You're in the UK, correct?
I am, yes. I'm in the UK. It's coffee time at the moment. It's in the morning, so I've got my caffeine ready to go. So it's a good start to the day.
Yes. Well, it makes two of us. I have my coffee ready to go here, too. I've actually been working a couple of hours already, so I'm good to go. How is lockdown treating you over there?
I mean, obviously it's a bit of a difficult thing to get used to. I mean, I'm somewhat of a hermit anyway, so for me the idea of being stuck at home, not seeing any other human beings for extended periods of time, is actually not really much of a change. I mean, I tend to spend a lot of my time working anyway. I'm a bit of a workaholic, so for me it's been an interesting time, but it's actually been a really productive time. I've had a chance to do a lot of things I wouldn't normally, so for me it's pretty much just been a solid year of just getting things done that otherwise would have been pushed to the side.
I completely agree with that. I mean, I'm an introvert as well. And I think for me, I live and work in Sweden, but I'm American. We're in lockdown. We're actually in worse lockdown now than we were in last year. But I work from home, and we have to work from home. And I found that the first year we did it worked well, and I just like you, I got a lot of things done. You know, those when you sit at the office, it's either you work or you're chit-chatting with colleagues.
Yeah.
And now it's like I work, and in the breaks I can work on my own stuff.
Yeah definitely. And then, I mean, for me,
okay, continue.
So I was just going to say, for me, I think the only issue with the lockdown is that you don't really have any breaks, at least for me. That kind of split between when you're working and when you're not working is a little bit blurred. So, you know, it's pretty much a year of just solid, you know, have I taken a break yet? No, I forgot to. Okay. I'll have one next week. It's fine.
Yeah, I found that I've actually been able to my writing would be mostly on the weekends, evenings and weekends, and at the expense of family, of course. But now I've also found that I don't have to put as much energy into to working on the weekends.
to do the writing on the weekend. Like, it's enough with a couple of hours, and then I'm kind of like, that demon is kind of satiated.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing. So how, I mean, has that made you, have you completed a bunch of projects then during this lockdown period? Are you, because I'm finding now that I'm all of a sudden, when this year started, I was just like, I don't really have any unfinished work.
it's an unusual feeling, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, for me, I'm exceptionally lucky in the sense that even before the lockdown, I was in a position where 90% of my time I could dedicate to writing or promoting or doing the kind of things that I need to do for that side of my career. I do other things as well, but I'm lucky in the sense that my family time is all kind of managed, and I mean I don't have a huge amount of responsibilities. I've got a son who's he's older now, so he does his own thing. He doesn't really want to spend any time with me. He's happier when I'm elsewhere. He's at that age. My work I tend to do from home anyway. A lot of it is writing based. So really for me, I'm incredibly lucky that even before lockdown, I had the opportunity to always have time to work.
Mm. No, because my kids are also older now, and they definitely don't crave as much attention, especially my oldest daughter who just like turned into a teenager and became a real teenager at that too, with all that entails. But they also go to school further away, so it's not like they're home all the time. So I find myself home alone for the first time, which I haven't actually been. My wife would be the one that would be home alone more often because her work is kind of shifty. So now I actually find myself home alone, and that's a very special feeling.
But it takes a little getting used to it.
It does. And it also keeps you from not doing, going off and doing something other than actually your work. I think I have to learn. It's like, I have to have routines, otherwise nothing will happen. Not even my work.
Yeah.
But when it comes to your writing, how long have you been writing? You talked about, I mean, because you're fortunate enough to write as your profession and write as a writer or as an author. So how long have you been doing that? When did you fall in love with the written word?
Well, to be honest, I've always been in love with words, but mostly talking rather than writing. I think for me, I was always very creative as a child, but it took me a long time to find a pathway to writing. So for me, I sort of went through all of the other creative fields before I got there. I did, I was a theatre school kid. I did dancing. I did ballet. I did singing, all sorts of different things, and eventually came to realise that I actually wasn't very good at any of them. And I sort of walked away from it for a little bit and just concentrated on a professional career. So I started down the path of working in business and training and development. And it was pretty good, and I was enjoying it. And then I just went through this period of about 3 or 4 years of just really turbulent issues in my career and things happening and recessions. And I found myself, for the, I think it was about the third or fourth time, being made redundant from a job that I didn't enjoy. I didn't get any fulfillment from it. And I think something in my mind just had like an epiphany where I just thought, okay, I'm just going to sit down and I'm going to try and write a book and see what happens. And I think at that point I sat down and for 6 solid weeks, I just wrote for like 12, 13, 14 hours a day. By the end, I had like these like withered claws instead of hands. And that was my first book. And I realized that I was in love with writing, and that was what I just wanted to do that for the rest of my days. And I haven't been back to full time work since. I just kind of dived straight into that pool. And that's where it all started.
Mm-hmm. I think there are similar, similar stories. And I mean, and you've listened to a couple of these podcasts, but I'm thinking, what brings me to mind is Tim Mendes and David Green, both of them UK-based authors, who had like that the same like a personal kind of almost like, I wouldn't want to say crisis, because that might be too much in your case. I don't know if you want to identify it as that. But that's what turns them to write. Always been in love with the written word, but then like something happens in their lives where they feels like, well, I have to do something, and I've always loved writing, and I have to kind of get it out of me this way, and then they don't look back.
Yeah.
And similar for me, I've been writing all my life, which I think a lot of writers also have and can say, but it wasn't until I myself had a personal moment of crisis then I started pursuing it as, you know, trying to get stuff published. So I think there's, you can look, and then I don't know how you feel about that, but people that I interview and talk to who have not dealt with the same thing and write their first book and get it published because right away, that kind of makes you feel like, well, I had to go through this whole personal journey. You get a little jealous of the people that don't have to do that, that just like sit down, write, get their first book published. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes, you know, you see people and it's amazing the way that some people just know exactly who they are as a writer. They know what they want to write and how they want to come across. I just think that for some people like myself, if I had have tried writing back years ago when I was going through my creative phase, I don't think I would have been able to write in the voice that I wanted to use. I think I had to wait until the time was right for me and I had that experience and that knowledge of who I wanted to be. You know, I think for some people it takes a little bit longer to get to that point, but when you do get there, I think you just absolutely know in your mind that, you know, this is the time for me now.
Mm. And maybe that is the difference between writers and writers of various kinds. It's like people know comfortable with their identity as a creative person early on. You know, they maybe find success early on, whereas others, like myself, who've been writing a long time, but didn't have any clue of what my identity was until I had like this personal epiphany, and then everything kind of falls into place. You know, maybe that's the answer to that, really. But the book that you sat down and wrote. Is that the book that you then published?
No, I actually wrote three books before I did We Men of Ash and Shadow, which is the one that I published. The first one I wrote in, like I said, it was 6 weeks, and I wrote, I think it was like 125,000 words, of which I think about 110 of them were just terrible. But it was just the start that I needed to get me there, and then I wrote a couple more, and I kind of ended up with this series that actually I was really proud of and I really enjoyed, but it wasn't the right book for me to publish at the moment. It's one that I think I'll come back to. And We Men of Ash and Shadow actually started out as a side project, funnily enough, and kind of just slowly kind of took over my brain and until it got to the point where I just couldn't do anything else.
So, you know, talk a little bit about that. I mean, because We Men of Ash and Shadow, you classify it as a grimdark, which is a very kind of interesting subgenre of fantasy to kind of start out with. The other books that you wrote, or the other stories that you wrote, were they of the same kind, the same genre, or did you choose something else?
No, I think the first three books that I wrote were very much straight up fantasy. They were very epic, kind of Lord of the Rings, that style of work, which is what I've always enjoyed. Mm. But I think I realised that although I enjoyed reading it, it wasn't something that I was built to write. I think I've got a little bit of a darker side to my writing, and also a little bit more of what I think of as a gallows humour that doesn't necessarily translate as well when you're trying to do something that is very, very straight kind of fantasy.
Mm. No, that's probably true. I mean, because if you look back at fantasy overall if you look at high fantasy, I mean, Tolkien, obviously, almost completely devoid of any type of humour. Whereas maybe like Weiss and Hickman, for instance, have it a little bit more. There's a little bit of a dark humor side to it. But it's not very common. It's very straight, as you said, and grimdark lends itself very well to the kind of humor. If you look at Joe Abercrombie, for instance, and stuff like that. Did you find that you had to research a lot of grimdark, or did it just kind of slowly morph? When you were done, was it like when you were done with it, it's like, hey, this isn't high fantasy at all. This is something completely different. Or did you set out to write something darker to begin with?
No, I set out to write something that was a little darker and a little edgier, but I hadn't specifically at that point really understood what grimdark was. I had kind of seen examples of it in one of the first books that I read that really kind of inspired me into that genre was Scott Lynch, The Lies of Loch Lomora, which is just this amazing example of how you can have a real kind of darkness, but again, have that real comedic value to it, where it's not just kind of blood and anger and guts. It's just these great relationships between these characters who are really kind of morally grey and ambiguous and just don't quite fit the normal kind of mold, if you will, of, you know, your protagonist, antagonist characters.
It's interesting that you mentioned Scott Lynch, because, and as an interviewer, you always feel like, I don't want to draw parallels with an author, as like, your work reminds me of this or that. But when I, and I haven't had the fortune to read your book yet, which I intend to do. But when I saw it and then I read the description, I immediately thought of Scott Lynch.
You know, it's a funny thing, because there's been quite a few people that have read the book and they've contacted me or they've reviewed it and they've said about the way it reads and the kind of other authors in the genre that it reminds them of. And there's such a wide spectrum of people that have come back and said, oh, this reminds me of Scott Lynch, this reminds me of Glenn Cook, and none of the authors they're picking are kind of particularly similar. So I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing, in that they're seeing lots of different authors kind of having inspired me, or if it just means that I maybe need to pick one style and go with that. But it's been really good actually to hear people, you know, picking out these authors and saying, oh, you know, when you wrote this, this bit reminded me of this person.
Well, I mean, for me, I think it had to do with maybe the setting a little bit. And I mean, because I haven't read it, so I can't say in particular that it, and I think inspiration, and they'll say like, this reminds me of this, or this voice is very much in this vein, or I liked Joe Abercrombie, so I like this because it's similar. As long as people don't say this is a complete like pastiche of, you know, whatever, I think that's probably good.
Yeah.
And I think we can't, as fantasy writers overall, I think you can't do anything without being compared to another one, because, I mean, fantasy in itself, I'm not going to say that it lacks originality, because it doesn't, but it's also very clear. I mean, fantasy readers expect a certain something from their fantasy books. You never describe an inn because people know what an inn looks like. We expect there to be elves. We expect there to be some form of troll, orc, or something like that. And that's what's expected. And that's what people like with the genre, because we know we expect it to be a journey of some kind, stuff like that. And I think in that case, that is probably a good thing when you're reminded of something. I mean, I would, but, and it could be a bad thing too, because you don't want to sound like you don't want to be reminded of something that you're not either. I mean, I wouldn't like my stories to remind people of David Eddings, for instance, because I don't care for David Eddings. So,
yeah, so, I mean, absolutely.
Continue.
No, I was just going to agree. I think there's just such a great feeling that comes from the compliment of being told that your work reminds people or has similar veins to authors that you admire or that you know are well liked. But I think it's the good thing as well is that when you get that, but also people saying it's also very unique, the way it's presented, the way that you write that style is in a different voice. So it's almost, it becomes like you feel like you're part of that genre a little bit more. It makes you feel more included in it.
As a female fantasy author, do you feel, I mean, because for a very long time, if you look at, like, historically, 70s, 80s, 90s even, women fantasy authors always wrote in a certain kind of style. It's always, you know, Mists of Avalon. It's often the Arthurian legend, because there's a lot to take there. There's a lot of, there's already a set romance. I mean, and I think it's not until, like, later years that we see a lot of female authors who break that boundary. Have you found, I mean, what other female fantasy authors have you looked at or been inspired by?
For me, strangely enough, as much as, you know, I feel like as a female writer, I should just reel off this list of, like, female fantasy writers, the majority of the writers that I really enjoy, female writers, tend to be more in the kind of horror and gothic genres. Mm. So for me, one of the best writers, or at least the one I've enjoyed the most, is Anne Rice, who wrote Interview with the Vampire. Her style of writing was just so poetic and had such a fluidity to it that when I read it, I just felt like it made me want to write even more, because it was just a really, really kind of amazing book to read, and it was so visual, the way that she writes. And I think that's the thing. I think with female writers, I think there's always been that leaning into the more darker, the more kind of violent or edgier stories. I just don't think that they've been in the fantasy genre specifically until more recently. And I think we're seeing a lot more crossovers where authors who wouldn't have been considered fantasy authors before are kind of leaning more into the fantasy elements of their writing. So I think there's some amazing female fantasy authors out there, and I think that there's a lot more to be discovered as well. But I think it's more of a case that they were always there in different genres, and now we're just kind of, we're moving in. We've bought our bags. We're moving in, and we're setting up shop.
Yeah, and I mean, I think most people would probably be, I think, very put, you know, I think it would be difficult for people to, you know, mention or name even 10, maybe, female fantasy, true, like, just simply fantasy authors, because I think there isn't that much, or they haven't gotten to the forefront yet, which I think it will happen. Just like we talk about, like, maybe fantasy authors of color, which is also very, very, you know, uncommon, because it has been a very, very white genre for a very, very long time. And the reason being that it's been a white genre and a male-dominated genre is, I mean, you have to look at the roots. I mean, what is it that fantasy authors from the beginning kind of were talking about? Well, they were afraid of the women's movement. They were very conservative. If you look at William Morris and all these early authors, it's like they want strong male figure saving the princess. You know, that's what we want. And I think Tolkien, in a way, is that, because, I mean, notoriously, he has, like, very few women in his books. So, and I think it's fine. And Anne Rice, I mean, I love Anne Rice. But I think find that she doesn't get enough credit today. I mean, she was very big in the 80s and 90s. And today, I find that she's slightly forgotten. What is your opinion on that?
I mean, I absolutely agree with that. I think that the way that she presented characters and characterization, especially of characters who weren't the typical, you know, good guy hero saving people and running around rescuing princesses, you know, she created these characters like Lestat, who were so utterly evil and despicable, but also so sympathetic and tragic, and there was just so many layers to the characters that she built that I think people would benefit so much from just reading it just as a character study, you know, to get this idea of how to build someone who can be good and bad at the same time.
And I think, you know, and that's, like, interesting, because I mean, I had this conversation with David Green while back, and it's like one of my favorite authors is Dan Simmons, and his as well. And I write nothing like Dan Simmons. I mean, it's not in the same genre, but I just love the way he presents characters and presents a story. And that's what, and even an author like Eric Larson, who just basically writes historical fiction, and I don't write historical fiction, but I just love the way he presents a character and the way he talks about, like, the landscape or the milieu. And that's kind of what I want to emulate in my writing, even though I write something completely different. And I mean, I think we have lots to thank Anne Rice for, but I'm wondering also if she kind of has fallen back by the wayside because other people have horned in on her area, say like the Twilight books, for Twilight Saga, for instance, stuff like that, which is less offensive in a way, because I mean there's a lot of stuff to unpack in Anne Rice's books, sexual ambiguity, even the ambiguity, as you said, of characters being good versus evil and stuff like that. And I think maybe people are just like, oh, that's a little bit too scary, too much for me. I just want to read about sparkly vampires who fall in love.
Yeah, which is fine if, you know, sparkly vampires is your kind of thing. It's definitely not my kind of thing, but, you know, there's room for everybody in the pool. I don't know, I think that there are some books that, you know, you'd read at kind of 10, 15 years after they came out, and they are a little dated, and especially with writing styles, they change so much over the years. And you look at the people who are writing now, like Anna Stevens and people like that, and their style is so different to what Anne Rice did. But what she did at the time was just so different and so exciting. So I think it's just a case of, I think, obviously people move on and I think styles change, but it doesn't invalidate, you know, what she did during her time, during her reign, so to speak.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, also, I'm thinking of, because a lot of people are reading Jim Butcher now, and people really like Jim Butcher's The Dresden Files, which is fine, because I mean, I can enjoy those as well. But I started, when it comes to urban fantasy in that way, I started reading Laurel K. Hamilton, which is kind of like she's a direct heiress to Anne Rice. And has a lot of similarities with Anne Rice, but she's completely forgotten, I think, because like Jim Butcher came and took her place. And I think that's kind of a shame, because here is a series of books that are really great on the same subject as the Dresden Files, and like she's completely forgotten, which is a shame.
Yeah, definitely.
But onto your own writing, your book, We Men of Ash and Shadow, self-published, correct?
It is, yes. Yes. Entirely self-published from cover to finish.
And how did that come about? Why did you choose to self-publish it? I mean, did you shop it around at all beforehand, or was it just like, you know what, I'm self-sufficient, right? I can do this all by myself.
I did initially go down the route of sort of exploration, and I had some tentative forays into the world of trad publishing. I did send out to a couple of different agents, and I had a few discussions with people, and following the discussions that I had, I just felt that for me, I wanted to be able to do this project completely by myself. As to use your term, self-sufficient, I was really keen to do things the way that I wanted them to, and to have control over the way it was marketed, the way it was promoted. Whether that was a good decision or not, that still remains to be seen. But for me, it was very much a personal choice. It was very early on, I think within about 3 months of sending out to people, I just knew that self-publishing was the way for me.
Mm. And was it difficult to do? I mean, to how much experience of anything of that kind of sort did you have, and how much time did you have to put into getting it just right?
The book itself, I never gave myself any real timelines for. It was very much this will be done when it's done sort of a project. Mm. When it came to the actual publishing of it and the marketing, I'm fortunate because I have had a little bit of experience, not in publishing a book, but in writing for businesses, writing guidebooks and training manuals, which all have to be done to a certain time scale and a certain level of professionalism. So for me, it was easy to slip back into that sort of routine of doing things to certain time scales in a certain order. The actual publishing of it was a really eye-opening experience for me because it was purely me on my own. I didn't have anyone to tell me where I was going right or where I was going wrong or what promotions would work. So for me, everything has been a baptism of fire. It's just been jump in the pool, hold your breath, hope you don't drown. try to see what works and what doesn't, which has been a lot of fun. And it's been a very steep learning curve.
Yeah, I completely agree, because me and two other guys have just taken over the European wing of an American publishing house. So we're kind of like in the middle of that. And we decided that the European authors that are already kind of in the mix, we were just going to kind of relaunch their stuff into a wider distribution, try to break the Amazon cycle and get books into, like, you know, bookshop.org, Book Depository, Waterstone, stuff like that. And that's been a starving turn because I it's the whole formatting process is so much like, I never realized you had to have like a different gutter margin as your regular margins or your trim sizes. And there's never one reliable source saying like, this is what it's supposed to look like. Like, you can have 1-inch margins on top and bottom, but I prefer 0.5 inches. And I just wish there was like a comprehensive, like, this is how it all standard, this is how it always is, and this is how it changes depending on size of the book and whatever. But it's a big step.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that would have been absolutely fantastic if I'd had some sort of guide, because it would have saved me from having just piles of books with different size margins and fonts just lying around, which is essentially what I've ended up with. So, yeah, we're just kind of using them as coasters now and filling up cupboards.
Well, those are the ones that you give away as presents to people that you kind of know.
Yeah.
You go to a party, it's like, here, my book. Don't open it now. You can read it later. You see that.
Yeah, exactly.
Because my brother actually bought my book, my debut novel, and it's one that is actually like incorrect margin. The gutter margin is horrible. But he didn't like pay attention to it. I just, can you just open it and show me? And he's just like, yeah. Gutter is completely off, but he didn't care. And that's good. And you chose to, and your book is available on Amazon now, and only Amazon. What was the decision of making it like Amazon exclusive? Is that just basically because they have a very good tool to use?
For me, it was a case of, because I'm quite familiar with the way that they work, it was really the easiest route for me to take. I did explore some of the other options, but having done things before for other people and other businesses, it was already something that I was quite comfortable with. So I would like to explore other channels in the future, but because it was the first time out and it was obviously all me doing this by myself, I just wanted that security that Amazon offer through their platform.
Mm. Well, would you still consider shopping like the next installment or the next book around, or are you happy continuing with the self-publishing bit?
For me, I am happy with self-publishing. I think there's an awful lot of fulfillment to be had from knowing that you've fully realized a project for yourself. Would I like to do traditional publishing in the future? I absolutely would. I mean, I think any writer who says they wouldn't is probably lying a little bit, because that is, you know, that is the dream. The dream is to have the book and the bestseller and be on, you know, all the bestseller lists and have a TV show. That's where I think essentially we'd all like to end up. But for me, it's always going to be a case of trying to compromise between what I want to do creatively and what I want to do professionally in terms of success and how I market myself and grow as an author. It's very important for me that it's 100% my voice that is coming through all the time. So for me, it would have to be the right publisher, the right agent, the right house to work with.
No, I mean, that's probably true. And I think it also depends on what you want out of it. I mean, yeah, the end goal of having a TV show and everything like that, that's good. But then you do have to go the traditional route, most likely of agent, one of the big publishers and not an indie publisher, maybe, you know, and then next step. Whereas other people that are just happy with having their books out and put out like 4 books a year, which I can find a little bit much. I mean, if you're going to be, I mean, because there's no time for people to gestate your book. It's like, because all of a sudden there's another book in the series out already. And then I think there's a risk of, I think a lot of indie authors feel like I need to have my name out there all the time. So there needs to be something all the time. And I think that's dangerous too, because that saturates the market. I mean, if you continue.
I just think that that's a really good point. I think with indie authors, there is this huge amount of pressure to constantly be in the eye of everybody you want to market to and promote to. And I think you do have to have a really good sense of self-discipline to take that step back every now and again and just let things be, just to have a break, to reflect, to do other things. And I think it's something that as authors we can forget very often that we need to do.
Yeah definitely. I mean, if you want to do that part, I would say probably go the short story route and try to get the, you know, stuff out to different anthologies if that's what you want to do. But like to put out novels in the same, you know, the same way Dean Koontz or Stephen King does, that's not really, there's always going to be a market for Stephen King and Dean Koontz, so they can do that, but it's not always going to be a market for indie authors. So tell us a little bit what We Men of Ash and Shadow is all about.
So We Men of Ash and Shadow, yes, the premise behind We Men of Ash and Shadow is it's a grim, dark gas lamp fantasy. So it's based around a city where it's a walled city and they're going through a period of, I'd like to say, recovery after a civil war, but actually they're very much still in that process of healing, and it's a very kind of dark, very desperate place. And the central character in the book is a mercenary who fought in this war. He now works as a hired assassin within the city. And the story is really his journey through this world that is still trying to recover from the pain and the turmoils of what they've been through as a country and particularly as a city. And he meets another young man who has a specific talent for stealth and is potentially someone that he could mentor. So it becomes about how they journey through the city together and how they kind of unearth the truths of what's really going on.
And I think you, when you say gaslight, I think that's what kind of made me think of Scott Lynch. But I mean, obviously your story is vastly different than that. It makes me think a little bit about, I mean, the game Dishonored, if you've played it or seen it. And I think that's, I mean, it's an interesting, because I think that type of story, that world isn't as explored. And I think it is something that probably appeals to a lot of people in this age of kind of like steampunk, diesels punk, and that whole halfway between being science fiction, being modern, but at the same time being fantasy. And I think books like that do very well today. Have you gotten good response from your book?
I have. I've been really lucky with the response that I've had, and particularly with people who have never really, like you said, they've never considered this as a specific point in time or an era that you would usually think of when thinking of fantasy. So your Victorian, your Edwardian, Napoleonic, all these eras, even right down to I'm very inspired by the French Revolutionary era. There's quite a lot of inspiration from stories like The Musketeers is just huge, huge inspiration for me. And I think these eras are just so ripe with potential for fantasy, and especially dark fantasy. I mean, these periods in time, you had so much turbulence and change technologically and in terms of how people acted, how they responded to each other. There's just so many opportunities for storytelling within them. It's just nice to put something out there that brings that to light, hopefully.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think that's that can be a difficult part somewhere, because when we talk, you mentioned dark fantasy and we've talked grim dark, but I think when people, and now I'm just going to get kind of like fantasy scholarly nerdy, because I can sometimes, but like the dark fantasy aspect, I think a lot of people mistake dark fantasy as being fantasy with horror elements, which I don't really personally find true by reading like the literature on it. I think dark fantasy is more of what you're saying is the dark side of humanity in a fantasy world, which is something that if you look at high fantasy, rarely see. We rarely see the reality of the poor farm boy, you know, what he has to endure in poverty in a medieval world. Because it's still all roses and you know, roses and bloom and everything like that. It's fine. He finds a magic sword and he goes out and he slays the dragon. Whereas that probably in a dark fantasy aspect, it's more of like he gets beaten. He's maybe an orphan. He gets beaten. There's maybe some rape scenes. I mean, humanity is dark, which it is, even in a fantasy world. I mean, would you agree with that aspect?
I would definitely agree with that. And I think that that's one of the things that I really wanted to put forward in not just this book, but in the entire series, is that the concept of fantasy being dark or grim dark or whatever term you use for your particular genre, it's about more than just the violence and the big battle scenes. It's very much about the human element. So that psychological effect of war, poverty, the traumas that these characters are going through. And I think that it almost becomes part of a very specific tone that is exclusive to grim dark and dark fantasy, certainly in my experience, where it's very real, it's very raw. You know, there are kind of real nerves exposed in the topics that you approach.
And because, I mean, the horror element in fantasy is always there, even in high fantasy. Tolkien uses a lot of horror tropes and horror elements in his books, and so does Robert Jordan. But that's, I mean, in a way you can look at it because fantasy comes from the horror fantasy. I mean, the horror genre. I mean, it's a natural step. I mean, you have horror, and then you have kind of like the science fiction part of horror, which turns into science fiction with Mary Shelley, and then there's the fantasy aspect. So I think to try to separate fantasy with a horror fantasy, it becomes a little bit redundant because fantasy is so connected to horror as it is. I think it's more interesting and in fact more fun if you use the psychological aspect, the dark side of humanity, like you're talking about.
Yeah, I think recently for me, one of the things that I've discovered is that, like you say, there are these very kind of blurred lines now between the different types of not only fantasy but also your horror, your sci-fi, and for me it's becoming almost to the point where the genres to me don't feel like genres. They almost feel like flavors is the word that I would probably use. And I think that's really good because I think that brings people who possibly wouldn't normally be the demographic for that genre into a whole new world of writing. So, I mean, I've explored writing and writers that I would never 10 years ago have picked up, but because there's now just these amazing crossovers and styles that are merging together, I'm actually finding that I am being introduced more to sci-fi, which is something that I never read before, and, you know, dark fantasies, which I wouldn't have really considered before.
No, that's, I mean, yeah, that is an interesting aspect. And I think I had that discussion with my sister just the other day, is that, like, she wouldn't either, you know, 10 years ago picked up a science fiction book, but because there is science fiction that is more appealing to her, like a Handmaid's Tale or The Giver or The Uglies, where it's more of a political future we're talking about than a technological, because you can still, if you enjoy science fiction and you enjoy the tech part of it, you can read hard fantasy or hard science fiction if that's what you love, but you don't have to anymore. And I think a lot of people make that mistake when they hear science fiction. It's like, oh, that's science, that's a lot of tech, that's the future, it's not for me. But
yeah, definitely.
Our time here is winding down. So tell me a little bit, what is next for you?
I'm currently actually working on the second book in the Vanguard series, which is, for me, really exciting because this is the point where we're going to start seeing these characters outside of the city and going into the wider world. So that's very exciting for me to write. I've also, I have a really busy time coming up. So I have a convention at the end of January, which is going to be a really fantastic online event, which is from the 25th, with a lot of other writers, some people I'm really, really excited to speak to, which is TBRCon 21. So that's something I'm really looking forward to. And I'm currently working on some gaming writing as well.
Okay.
So that'll be my project next few months.
Exciting. Yeah, it sounds like an exciting time.
Yes. Yeah, it's a lot going on. It's a lot to remember.
Any chance we're going to see Wee Men of Ever Ash and Shadow as a game?
I mean, I would love to think so. I'm a huge gaming fan. I'm a huge fan of the Assassin's Creed series, so, you know, I would love to see Vanguard's character turned into something along the lines of an Assassin's Creed stealth style character and used in a game. That would be the dream for me, probably more so than a TV show, definitely.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it doesn't rule out a TV show, obviously, as we've seen.
This is true. I could just have everything.
And well, I mean, and that's the thing is, like, and I think that's a little envious of you, because when I played Dishonored, and even read the Loch Lamora books, I was just like, I would like to write something like that, but I don't know if I have. I mean, I think I don't know. I think I'll stay where I am, because I think I don't think I have the skills for it, but I would like to. I would like to immerse myself in that world, but I think there are others that do it better than me.
I think you never know. I think I didn't at any point sit down and think I want to write a book that is this style or that is this what Wee Men of Ash and Shadow came to be. But in the end, it's just the book that was right for me and it was what came out. So I think the potential to surprise yourself is always there with writing. You don't know what the next thing that's going to pop into your brain is gonna be. It could be anything.
That is completely true. So if people want to find you on the internet, on social medias and stuff like that, want to connect with you, obviously your book Women of Ash and Shadow available on Amazon at the moment, but if they want to connect with you, talk to you, ask you questions, where can they connect you?
The best place in terms of connecting with me is probably Twitter, because I seem to live half of my life on Twitter, for better or worse. I do have a blog and a website as well, which is HL Tinsley Writes. So you can contact me through there as well. But I am a prolific social media person. So generally, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning, if you have a question, just pop it on Twitter and you'll probably get an answer pretty quickly.
Probably shouldn't say that, because now you're going to get a bunch of questions at 4 o'clock in the morning. Okay. Well, it's been a delight talking to you. And we hope to talk to you again sometime soon. I would like to get together, because we have not so much anymore, but the plan for this show at times was to have like an author roundtable where we discussed like different topics of especially genre fiction. And I'd like to put together a fantasy one sometime, and it will be fun to have you on then.
Yeah, that sounds absolutely great. I love that idea. I'm all on board for that. So thank you very much for having me. It's been really good to talk to you.
Yes, the same. And we'll talk to you again soon, I hope. And I'm going to be picking up your book as soon as possible.
Thank you very much. It's been really, really good talking.
Welcome back. Very good interview, very interesting. There was a little bit of a delay in the chat there, so I mean there was kind of like pauses here and there, but I mean most of all it worked out very good. I hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget to check out H.L. Tinsley's book, We Men of Ash and Shadow, available on Amazon, both in book form and Kindle. Don't forget to, you know, follow her on social medias, and I'd just like to thank her for coming on. I'd like to thank you for listening. Please follow us on Instagram or Twitter or on Facebook. All those links available. I'd like to thank John Holtman for the music. And I'll talk to you next week. Bye.